Okay, people, take your seats. At this time, we'll convene the Committee on Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications. And there were a few people left over from our last meeting who did not have time to testify, so I will call on them. And the first, please come in, take your seats, and be quiet. Deborah Bergen. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deb Bergen, and I'm Manager of State Legislative Affairs for Western Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, which is the financing affiliate for Missouri River Energy Services. Missouri River Energy Services has 60 member municipal electric communities. They are located in Minnesota, Iowa, South, and North Dakota. And 24 of these 60 members are located here in Minnesota, mostly along the western border with North Dakota and South Dakota. In the past, Missouri River Energy has opposed the adoption of a renewable energy standard for a variety of reasons. However, Missouri River and our public power colleagues wish to respond proactively to the public demand for renewable energy. Therefore, Missouri River Energy, along with other municipal utility groups, work together to identify the issues that must be addressed to make a standard that is achievable. The product of our work can be found in Senate File 129, Senator Tomasoni's bill. Missouri River Energy urges the adoption of a standard that also addresses transmission by streamlining the regulatory process and by acknowledging the reality of a rapidly changing energy industry. Missouri River has some concerns about the adoption of a 25% standard to be met by the year 2020 that I would like to bring to the committee's attention. First, Senate File 129, Senator Tomasoni's bill, is geared towards developing transmission that will be needed to make a standard achievable. I cannot stress enough that if these transmission issues are not addressed in the renewable energy standard bill, a standard of any amount will be difficult to achieve. For example, on January 18th of this year, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issued an order designating much of southern Minnesota and northern Iowa as a narrow constrained area, or NCA. This means that the existing grid in that area is so inadequate that interconnection generation resources must be curtailed or limited. This affects 77 generation facilities, almost all of which are located here in Minnesota. Senate File 129 contains provisions that would streamline the certificate of need and resource planning processes. It also contains provisions to delay or modify the standard if extra time is needed to address issues that are out of a utility's control. For example, lack of transmission or transmission constraints, lack of available wind turbines, or permitting delays. Transmission is inextricably linked to a renewable energy standard. The wind integration study itself, which you've heard testimony about, states that wind generation cannot be controlled or precisely predicted. Therefore, energy from wind generating facilities must be taken as delivered, which necessitates the use of other controllable resources to keep the demand and supply of energy in balance. Merely assuming that adequate transmission will be in place is not enough. To accommodate a 20% standard by 2020, at least 4 to 5 345 high-voltage kV lines will be needed, and that will be roughly at a cost of $2.5 to $3 billion. And that is over and above the transmission already planned for CapEx Groups 1 and 2 and the Big Stone 2 planned transmission project. And this brings me to Missouri River Energy's second concern, the cost for ratepayers. Missouri River Energy Services is owned by the customers we serve. We're a not-for-profit entity, so therefore all our rates are cost-based. And like all public power entities, the cost of maintaining, operating, and building resources and transmission is borne by the customer owners who are living in each of our member communities. Therefore, public power entities like Missouri River Energy Services must be conscious of the impact that legislative policy will have on utility rates that are paid by the local school, the local grocery store, and even by the ethanol plant, which is employing some of these citizens in these communities. At the same time, we do desire to protect the environment and by increasing renewable fuels as an overall part of our overall portfolio, as part of baseload peaking, and other intermittent resources. Senate File 129 protects ratepayers from undue burdens and cost shifts. It protects the environment by adding wind resources to the mix and takes an approach that implements an achievable renewable standard while carefully balancing the utility energy portfolio. Since the Senate's passage last year, Senate File 2798, public power entities like Missouri River Energy Services looked at whether they can meet the 20% by 2020, which was contained in that bill. We determined that we could meet the standard at Missouri River Energy Services, but it will be difficult. And it can only be done if sufficient transmission is available, if and only if it's available. If a 25% standard were to pass, of course, Missouri River Energy Services would do its best to try to meet it. Because as I sit here today, I cannot say I can guarantee that we will meet it by 2020, and I cannot guarantee what impact it may have on rates, and I cannot guarantee what impact it may or may not have on economic development, but we will try. Again, I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak today, and I'm open for any questions.
Ms. Bergen, you mentioned that three to four and maybe five lines are necessary to meet your needs. This is for Missouri River Energy Services itself.
Madam Chair, I mean that for the state of Minnesota to meet the renewable energy standard of 20% by 2020, it's estimated that beyond the CapEx Group 1 and 2 projects, there will need to be an additional four to five.
And how much did you say that would cost?
The rough estimate I've given is $2.5 to $3 billion.
Okay. And then the other thing you said, you mentioned the NRA, the
NCA.
NCA, narrow sorry, too many additional.
Yes.
No NRA in here. NCA. And you said that it was too weak an area. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I will try. It's narrow, constrained area. And I'm not a transmission engineer, so I will put this in the best light possible. In that area of the state, the transmission lines are already overburdened or constrained. So bidding on generation or bidding to put generation in that area has been curtailed. In addition, my understanding of an NCA also means that for the generators in that area, there will be times in which they cannot generate due to transmission constraints.
So does that mean that for there to be further generation in that area, the transmission line needs to be upgraded or does it need or replaced or that other transmission lines need to be developed?
Chairman Solon, I'm sorry, I am not prepared to answer that question, unfortunately. I do know what it means is that there are constraints in that area which will be need to be met. Now, whether it needs to be met for by upgrades in that particular area or elsewhere on the grid or whether that means there needs to be new transmission lines elsewhere in Minnesota, I do not know.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions, Senator Anderson?
Madam Chair, just to follow up on your question, I don't know exactly where this area is, but does it include the area that would be served by the Big Stone plant?
No, I do not believe it does. It would be closer to the southeastern area of Minnesota and northern Iowa.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Bergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bill Haney?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Bill Haney, and I am a legislative and political director for the IBEW. Minnesota State Council. We have 13 locals in the State Council covering virtually the whole state. We have predominant two groups of members in the locals of the State Council, our electricians and utility workers. We had our annual meeting this week, and we voted to support a 20% mandate by 2020 with the appropriate off-ramps for, not being able to meet it, and also with appropriate assurances that transmission capacity would be available for getting the product to market. That's the end of my statement.
Okay, thank you.
Questions?
Yes. Senator Olsen.
Did you say 20% by 2020? Because I'm interested if that was what you said, that, you know, that's not the governor's bill and it's not Ellen Anderson's bill. So I'm wondering where that number came from.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Haney.
Senator Olsen, that's a number that had been talked about for some time, and we looked at the different percentages of mandate that we were aware of being talked about this year, and that's what we felt comfortable saying or supporting this year. If we were to look beyond that again, we'd have to look at the specific language and what the off ramps are able to do and what sort of accommodations are available for transmission capacity to get the product to market.
A follow-up, if I may?
Yeah, Senator Olsen, though, 20% by 2020 is both in the governor's bill and in Senator Tomasoni's bill.
Okay, thanks. What does labor feel about this, though, overall picture? Do they see it as kind of a jobs growth, or what's their view on this moving to wind energy and the transmission of that power?
Mr. Haney.
Madam Chair, Senator, I can't speak on behalf of all organized labor, only on behalf of the IBEW unions in this state. And we represent most of the utility workers in the state. The existing baseload power plants provide a lot of ongoing operating jobs, probably less than some of the different renewables would provide on an operating basis as you go forward once they're constructed. Both facilities provide a lot of construction jobs for electricians and all kinds of other people in the trades.
Okay. Senator Koch.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Haney, first of all, thank you. Probably the most succinct presentation we've had on the subject. Appreciate that. My question to you just is, do you have any idea of your current membership, how many are working on current wind projects? Any idea of your...
No,
Mr. Haney?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, I don't have an idea as to how many are right now. I know that over the past several years, there's been a number of members that have been involved in the construction portion of wind towers throughout Minnesota and Iowa. And I know that several of the locals are working together to try to see what we could do to facilitate more construction, wind construction.
Okay.
Senator Koch?
Oh, no follow-up on that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Mr. Haney. Dwight Anderson? Welcome, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some handouts for the folks here.
Do you want us to wait for your handouts, or do you wish to begin?
The handouts start a little bit later, so I can go ahead and start.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dwight Anderson. I'm the Project Development Manager at Minnesota Power in Duluth, Minnesota. My work involves utilizing my experience in engineering, operating and maintaining generating plants, knowledge of how industrial processes work in our region, coupled with what I like to think is some West Central Minnesota farm boy common sense, to assess the technical and economic viability of various generation technologies that we look to use to meet our customers' energy needs. The purpose of my testimony today is to provide you information about a technology that makes it possible to capture the energy in low-temperature waste heat from industrial processes. We can use this energy along with wind, biomass, hydro, and hopefully other new technologies that probably even aren't on a radar screen yet to meet our customers' future needs with renewable resources. A fundamental trait of all processes that use fuel is that they give off a stream of waste heat. Finding ways to economically capture and convert that waste heat into electricity is challenging. I have a personal experience with that back in 1992 when we were involved with doing industrial energy audits. I tried, unfortunately unsuccessfully, to find ways to economically convert a waste heat stream to electricity. It was now the U.S. Steel KTAC facility up in Keewatin, Minnesota. At that time, the lack of an existing steam-based generation system that I could leverage and the small scale made the costs of the project prohibitive to proceed. More recently, though, in 2006, we commissioned a study to take a look at a technology we come across called binary power generation. And we felt that that shows great promise in our ability to turn what today is a waste product into electricity. Technology has actually been used for many years in the geothermal generation business. What is new is that is the application of that technology to waste heat. An example of the initial deployment of that technology is actually now occurring in natural gas compressor stations in the Dakotas. One of those efforts is in your handout. It was recently completed by Basin Electric. That project, roughly four units, I think they started construction in September 2005, got it in service just last fall. It's producing roughly 22 megawatts of power. And the nice part is it's generating that power with no incremental emissions. It's not changing the footprint of what's occurring on the site. I'd like to take a few minutes to provide you some more details about the technology. Binary generation has some similarities to conventional steam power generation in that we start with a liquid, we compress it, we heat it to form a gas, expand it through a turbine, turbine spins a generator, we condense it back to a liquid form, and then we start the process all over again, keep it going. In a power plant, we use sources of fuel, whether it be coal, natural gas, biomass, or even nuclear power, it's all kind of the same. What is different in a binary cycle is the working fluid. Binary cycles typically use things like pentane or propane or other organic compounds. The reason that they use those is they have advantages. They're better suited to capturing energy at low temperature, and they don't freeze, which makes them capable of operating remotely. Remote operation is real important in making typically, they're fairly small scale, maybe 5 megawatts. Those basin projects were roughly 5 megawatts to get to 2022. And they run remotely, just as the gas compressor stations are, other than people coming in to check on them periodically. In the handout, I provided a diagram of the process, and I don't want to get into the – love to get into the detail, but I don't think you want me to get into the detail. Okay. In this particular case, it's actually a diagram that would be representative of what's occurring in those plants in Dakota. In this case, there's a waste heat source. It's the gas turbine exhaust. The gas turbine is connected to a compressor, actually fueled off the line, and that's used to spin the compressor to keep the pressure up in the line and deliver the natural gas to other end users down the line. Because, unfortunately, the natural gas is not located where the consumers are. That waste heat is recovered in a heat exchanger, and you actually use thermal oil It's a substance used in a lot of industry. Picks up that heat, and then it transports it over to, call it the power block, with it, and they got a kind of a, I'm colorblind, so forgive me, I think it's blue box around it. It's called the Ormat Energy Converter. That's a particular manufacturer, and there's others out there. That what's inside that box is actually what's the part that's used in the geothermal industry. So what they've done is they've taken that technology, left that block kind of the same, and what they've added is the heat recovery side, that heat exchanger inside the gas turbine exhaust. And I won't go into detail. I talked about that already, how you evaporate the pentane, run it through a turbine, it spins the turbine, kind of like a pinwheel, put a generator on the end. You've got to condense it, and that's what the there's a picture there of the condenser. And then I got to pump it up once it's back to a liquid to get to the high pressure to evaporate again. Only discharge that occurs from that closed loop process is waste heat from the condenser, and that is in the form of warm air. I mean, you've got 120, 130, 150 degree air coming out of that. The net effect what's there is that instead of the gas turbine discharge going to atmosphere at maybe 900 degrees Fahrenheit, you take a portion of that waste heat out. You can't take it all. Nothing's free in this world. And then it ends up being cooled down, and so it exhausts the gas turbine at a lower temperature, or actually on bypass duct, it leaves the process. One of the keys to these applications is they typically go into an industrial process. Those processes typically run round the clock. And the nice part is if we put one of these with that, we produce power on a base load basis. I mean, 7x24 coming in all the time. That operating characteristic provides us a very good fit with our customer needs in northeastern Minnesota. Minnesota Power is working hard to apply what we learned from that research in 2006, develop generation opportunities with our industrial customers. At this point, we don't know the overall magnitude of what can be done in our service territory, but if we were able to successful in bringing maybe 40 to 50 megawatts of this base load resource online, the amount of energy that we would produce would be in the same range of what we're going to receive from the 100 megawatts of wind projects that were involved in North Dakota. Considering those numbers is important to note, though, that where we're putting those wind turbines in North Dakota is a premier wind spot, very high average speeds of wind. And a comparable 100-megawatt project in our northeastern Minnesota region, which is not as good a wind resource, would generate less energy. And on an annual basis, as you compared that to a waste heat project, we'd only need maybe 25 to 35 megawatts of that waste heat to produce the same amount of energy. In the context of Minnesota Power's load, that's a big deal, and it's important to us. Waste heat is an important renewable generation option because, like wind, hydro, and biomass, it captures and converts into electricity something that would otherwise be unused and wasted. Agreement with our position that waste heat is renewable is evident, and in your handout are some copies of letters from agencies in South Dakota and North Dakota. In those letters, both states have classified energy from waste heat as a renewable resource. In addition, as my colleague Margaret Hodnick has previously testified, in the state of Nevada, waste heat recovery is qualified in their statutes as a renewable resource. In addition to having the attractive characteristics of no criteria pollutant emissions and a zero climate change footprint, waste heat recovery like hydro, biomass, and hopefully some wind projects in our service territory would provide a chance for distributed generation in our territory that does not require major transmission projects. In closing, I would like to reiterate the message that my colleague Margaret Hodnick has put forward in earlier testimony. She stressed the importance of a selective, flexible definition of what is renewable as you craft your statute. This will allow us to put together an optimum renewable portfolio for our customers. One example of flexibility is to encourage baseload renewable energy resources in addition to intermittent. They all have a place at the table. Waste heat energy affords a very good opportunity to do just that. As a person directly responsible for identifying and developing projects to meet the renewable goals of Minnesota Power, as well as the state of Minnesota, I strongly believe that a flexible language will also allow us to take advantage of existing and new technologies. Binary energy was new, but it's a new application, to better utilize the renewable fuels that are available to us. We must create opportunities to produce power from our environment with either minimal or no emissions of criteria pollutants at a smaller carbon footprint in a way that keeps our customers competitive in their global markets. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, any questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is on this diagram here. When the hot gas is going to that chamber and they're released, how much of that goes back out in the atmosphere? I might have missed that. You might have said something already. Is there some emissions still?
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Dahl, they don't mix together. So all of the whatever goes in goes out. So the 900 degrees and whatever constituents are in those exhaust gases, which would be a combination of nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and nitrous oxides and some other cats and dogs, is what's going to go out, but it'll go out at a lower temperature.
Okay.
That's
the heat. That's the heat.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
It's a lower temperature, so I don't know. Madam Chair, I guess, wait, we just want to clarify. So the same amount of CO2, et cetera, would go out as would go out otherwise, correct? Is that what you just said? It'd just be at a lower temperature?
Mr. Anderson.
What I heard you say?
Senator Anderson, yes, whatever is in that base stream will go out. However, at the end of the day, what we've done, if we didn't do anything, that stream would go out. But now what we've done is created, in the case of those projects out in Dakota, roughly 5 megawatts of generation that otherwise would not have been created.
Sure.
So in essence, you're saying that it's halved because it's been used twice? Maybe that's not a good analogy.
it's reducing the losses that occur. It's a loss, but it's an uncaptured loss, and it's almost an opportunity. I would put it in terms that are similar to, as you look at other renewables, you have, hydro, our project at Fond du Lac that we're working on. That project is hoping to capture water that's flowing over the dam and still get it to the same place but generate some power in the meantime.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm trying to first understand what Minnesota Power's project is, and that your project as a company would involve this pipeline, correct? Or you're talking, is that right?
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Anderson. The things we'd be looking at, we do have a pipeline that runs through our service territory, and those would be very good candidates for it. We also have industrial customers that have waste heat, like the waste heat example I talked about in Keewatin. Those are other candidates for it. Are there a lot of them? Probably not. But, if you can start stacking together 5 megawatt chunks, and like I said earlier, it's a fair amount of energy into our system, and our system not being terribly large, it's a big thing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, we've talked about the concept of cogeneration in the past, and I think there's lots of power plants that, and also industrial plants that have waste heat. And so do I understand that what you're talking about, if you were to call that renewable, then any plant that had waste heat and would use it to make electricity, that would be captured, that would be considered renewable energy?
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Anderson, I think the things that we would focus on are those processes that are discharging that heat already, and so that any means of capturing that would be a plus to the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I guess my comment would be that, and I've already expressed this to you, that I think this is a great a great way to use a waste product to make energy, and that's a really good thing, and I think we ought to encourage it or provide it's a good thing to provide incentives for if we're interested in doing that. But I hesitate to call it renewable energy. That I would have, to me, that seems like a stretch to call it renewable. So I just have a little trouble picturing this as something that we would consider renewable. It's really an issue of being more efficient with a waste product, using it more efficiently and getting more energy for the same fuel source than you would get otherwise.
Well, Senator Anderson, it may be a question of semantics because actually it is recycled, and mm-hmm. so it is renewable energy in my way of thinking. But I don't know if you're finished. I was going to call on another speaker, but are you finished?
I'm finished. Yeah.
Okay. There are other people that want to address this too. Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, is that typically the efficiency that you get out of these pumping stations, and are they typically only gas turbines? Because I see the 850 to 950 degrees discharge, that's relatively inefficient. And I guess I'm wondering if you would call the capturing of this waste energy renewable, is there any incentive to make those initial gas turbines any more efficient?
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Carlson, actually a 900-degree exhaust on a gas turbine is a pretty good temperature, even on the new class industrial frame machines have a temperature maybe up around 1,000. And I'm not a gas compressor or a gas pipeline expert, so this is my gut feel type answer here. The key to the gas compressors are located, and I think it shows it on the diagram in that basin electric part of your handout. They're spaced along the pipeline, and a lot of them are they're far apart. The scale is fairly small, so just as I ran into in Keewatin on the project I looked at there, what we sometimes could do is you could put a heat recovery steam generator and you could make regular steam power out of that. However, of that scale, it doesn't make sense. So through the years, and once you put water there, then you can't put people. You need people because stuff freezes. You have makeups. And so what's occurred is the economics have been such that it was made more sense to just to have the simple cycle and exhaust the waste gas. Your question also, you mentioned are there other technologies? There are some reciprocating engine driven, some other ones which have a different profile. But in this case, they're looking at gas turbines.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Anderson, the reciprocating engines, those are used quite prolifically too, aren't they? I'm familiar with some, for instance, I think it was People's Gas, which I'm not sure who they're mm-hmm. called now, but they used piston engines, reciprocal engines, and I'm not sure what the comparison is of efficiency between the two types of prime movers.
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Carlson, the exact efficiency difference I wouldn't be able to tell you. Typically, the reciprocating engines are used on smaller scale stations. These are fairly large units, 20,000-30,000 horsepower equivalent. Where if you were to do that reciprocating engine, they become capital cost doesn't make sense. There's also maintenance issues.
So, Senator Carlson, I'm not sure if the direction of your question. Are you saying this is not an energy efficient method, or that it?
Madam Chair, I would.
Is this an argument for it being renewable or toward conservation?
It would not be, because what it is it's really locking yourself into something that I would feel is not terribly efficient. You're discharging an 850 to 950 stream of gases, and once you had put a system on it to use that temperature of exhaust gases, you'd be locked into it. You wouldn't be going to a more efficient pumping. The whole system is to pump gas, a gaseous substance of some type, and it's natural gas. And you need to have some kind of a prime mover there to pump it. And what we're doing is we're taking the advantage of the hot gases that are coming out of it. So once you put in this system, you'd be locked into that prime mover, no matter what you would find that might be more efficient. Now, I don't know that there are devices that are more efficient than a gas turbine in this application. But typically in engineering, the output temperature is a measure of efficiency of that prime mover.
That wasn't my understanding, but maybe, Mr. Anderson, would you like to respond to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Similar to what I found up in Keewatin, as I worked on that waste heat alternative, industry through the years, as fuel prices kept going up, they've become much more efficient. I know in the taconite industry, they used to exhaust a lot of waste heat. And I believe it was in the 70s, the design and technologies improved, that they found ways to recuperate that heat. And so they've kind of maximized what they can do. And so it's still, at the end of the day, there's still some waste heats, as these cats and dogs, I call it, that are available to capture. And that's where this technology has a good niche to bring that in, where, but for this technology, that stream would continue to go to the atmosphere.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it certainly sounds compelling, and the temptation is quite large to say sure. You know, sounds great. I may be a little gun shy. Lots of people are piling on board after the experience of seeing a coal plant try to declare itself out, successfully declare itself renewable and glom onto a significant number of dollars for development of new renewable technologies. So part of me, is tempted to go along and say, sure, let's declare this renewable, but, it feels like we might be looking at another camel's nose under the tent sort of situation. And I do wonder if this isn't a more appropriate discussion for an efficiencies or a conservation type of policy conversation that we're going to be having in the near future, I understand. I hope so, because I've got some ideas around that as well. But my question is... a couple. One is, if you provided this information, I apologize for not catching. But what is our estimation of the total potential for capturing waste heat, in the Minnesota Power service area, or statewide? Does this get us a ton of energy? Does it get us significantly closer to, a 25? If we were to lump it into the definition of what is renewable, does it get us to what Senator Anderson is proposing, 25 by 20, particularly in light of what I think I heard you say, that there's not a significant amount of new transmission that would be needed, which seems to be everyone's big barrier here. Does that get us significantly closer to be able to do what Senator Anderson is proposing to do? That's my first question.
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Dibble, we haven't done the detail. Their report was just dated January 7, so we're busy now trying to really define what that universe of opportunity is for us. My intuition tells me that it's not it is a solution and not the solution. It's going to help along with maybe some additions in biomass, with we've got this hydro project at Fond du Lac that we're going to do that's going to bring us 35,000 megawatt hours a year in that range. And wind, and we're actively working on wind. But we think, in our opinion, we need to have this portfolio and be able to make sure we capture all of the various resources. And by far, wind probably has the greatest resource out there. I mean, that's got the largest magnitude that provides opportunity, but we think it would be remiss not to capture these other opportunities as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Well, that would be really, really useful information for the committee to be able to evaluate. Also, the other kinds of information that's well developed in some of these other areas. I'm not a purist. I don't think it should be just wind or just, as new ideas crop up, we should consider them and consider lumping them into renewable definitions. But, we need to understand those questions. We need to understand what the implied additional economic benefit is in terms of jobs and investment and that sort of thing. That's really well developed with some of these other technologies and these other ideas. And finally, my question is, it occurs to me that, we're relying on the processes that other industries are engaged in. We're capturing the waste heat from other industries, other factories, And as we well know, especially with the experience in the Iron Range, but certainly all across the metro area, the Ford plant, nothing is forever. So what do we do about, you know, attaching a lot of our energy resources to third parties that may or may not exist in perpetuity? How do we, you know, there's a reliability factor. It's not a daily reliability factor, but it might be kind of an annual reliability factor. We're hooking up generation to companies that may be acquired by some international conglomerate and moved out of the state.
Well, Senator Dibble, I think that that perhaps doesn't relate to this situation. First of all, I get concerned when we start talking about the jobs that are being created, because this is not an economic development policy. This is an energy policy. And there will be time later when we will talk about economic development policy. But right now, we're talking about energy policy. We're talking about stopping greenhouse emissions. And we're talking about less reliance on fossil fuel energy and more reliance on renewable energy. And the other thing we're looking at is that there are various characteristics in the state that affect different utilities and different areas in different ways. Now, Minnesota Power is a industry that has, am I right, 70% of your client base is industrial load?
A very large percent in that range, yes.
And so they have, and I think you've missed some of these meetings, and so others will bear with me as I repeat this, that 70% of their load is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so they have a harder time dealing with the interruptibility of the wind generation. They need a base load that is continuous. And this becomes one of those renewable sources that would be able to supplement that. They are looking for wind energy also. And so there were some questions at the last couple of meetings about whether this is a form of renewable energy that would be acceptable. And what we've tried to do is to be as encompassing as possible. If our goal is renewable energy, less reliance on fossil fuel energy, then we need to save the discussion for a new industry in Minnesota for when we get to other parts of our process.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just sharing some of the thinking as we evaluate this proposal and this idea. Certainly, the issues I described that I touched on are well used by many of the testifiers and the proposers of these various bills as rationales and justifications for proceeding with some significant policy changes. Yes,
Senator, I agree with you, and I support those also. But I'm also asking you and urging you to be aware of the different features of the different utilities and how our policy affects them.
I shepherded the Mercury bill last year. I've dealt closely with all the utilities and their variations and their needs, and I'm well acquainted with Minnesota Power, and we accommodated Minnesota Power in that Mercury bill.
Okay, thank you. Did you have other questions?
No.
Okay. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Mr. Anderson, maybe it's after that discussion more of a comment. I think we agree, Madam Chair. I think it enters into the renewable in as much as what we're looking at in terms of renewables is utilizing something that's otherwise waste or not being used. Wind, it's renewable. It's out there. If we use it, it's renewable energy. So we're taking a waste stream and we're utilizing it. So I think it definitely qualifies there, as does biomass. When we pick up biomass, it could be something that we're burning that's not used someplace else. So it qualifies under those kind of definitions. So I think we need to be open-minded in terms of that as we look forward, because we don't want to close the door and we don't want to say, well, if we don't count it at all, then people will not utilize new technologies that recover that. It gives us more energy without increasing a carbon footprint or increasing greenhouse gases. So again, it gets us to an objective. And whether it's this or another technology, I think we have to be open-minded that way. Under the worst-case scenario of trying to understand what the other side's opinions are going back and forth, because we do go back and forth on our opinions, is maybe, just maybe, this might qualify as the kind of item that we don't count as a full unit, if you will, where we do start assigning a percentage as opposed to a freestanding wind generation unit. But I definitely don't want it to be excluded as a renewable, because we're taking something that's otherwise wasted and using it to generate without creating a new source of emissions.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to belabor the issue, but Senator Dunbar said, if we all sit back and remember the conversations about renewables that we had, well, I've only been here, you know, my fifth year, but it was a hard push to even get people start to thinking about renewables and wind. And the very words that were issued today, efficiency and reliability, for this very process is the same thing they were using on wind. So we do need to keep our minds open and think about the future and not just earmark what we have on at the table right now.
Okay. The other thing is that we want to share standards as they are addressed across the country. And there are apparently other states that are allowing this process as a renewable energy. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I don't know if you talked about, and if you did, I apologize. Did you talk about the cost of implementing this technology? And is it something that your company would find cost-effective to do with or without it being included in a renewable energy incentive? Is it something where you could make some money selling this power?
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Anderson, we're in the early stages yet of putting those things together. We're hearing some things from the vendor. We have not verified them yet. The things that we've heard are encouraging. We're hearing capital cost in the $2,000 a kilowatt range. Now, it's not like wind. There's no there's nobody out there charging somebody for wind. So there, you know, the fuel in this case is waste heat, and we're going to locate on a customer's project. Customers, and you learned this from the days when I did energy audits, they want to make tons of something, whether it's tons of paper, tons of taconite. I mean, their bottom line is affected by that. So they got to make sure that, A, this doesn't impact their ability to efficiently and cost-effectively make their product. And so they're going to be looking for something. There's going to be something on their site. So there's going to be some sort of a payment probably for that waste heat on top of that. I mean, the benefit that we see is of being a base load resource, high capital cost and base load, they go a little bit better together than if it's a low base load or a low capacity factor unit.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
I think Senator Dibble mentioned this, but I guess if this committee is interested in this idea, I'm just going to wait. Then I think we do need some more information about what is the extent of waste heat projects around the state that could be considered to fit. If you're proposing some kind of a definition, we need to know some information about how much that would be, how many megawatts we're talking about, and, you know, so then we could have something, so we could compare it with how much we're talking about of other renewables. So I don't know how to collect that information, but I think that would be a critical piece of information for us to have in front of us. And I don't think Mr. Anderson probably can, he already said that's not really information he has, but I don't know how to find that, but I'm just going to put that on the table that I'd like to get that information.
Mr. Anderson, excuse me, can you respond to that?
Senator Anderson's right. I don't have that number. The only thing I can think of in our service territory, we do have a pipeline running down through it. If you looked at their diagram, the diagram in that basin, little blocks in there were compressor stations. So I don't know if there was five or however many there were. And if you think if it was similar, I believe we have three compressor stations in and around our system that are a reasonable size, so maybe that's 15 megawatts. Large industrial customers could be the next tier that you'd go after. Taconite plants, we have five, six of those plants. You know, so again, if you can do 5 megawatts or 10 megawatts there, you know, we're not talking something that's probably, at least for certain in our service territory, that's 500 megawatts of capability out there. It's a smaller number.
I'm not sure what difference that would make, though, Senator Anderson. Aren't we wanting to encourage as much renewable energy use as possible?
Madam Chair.
It, Yes, Senator Anderson. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we want to utilize as much as possible renewable energy, and so we would want to encourage the use of any type of renewable energy that is going to decrease our reliance on fossil fuel.
Madam Chair, I completely agree with you. However, I don't think this is renewable energy in the sense of what I think of renewable energy. I think it's a really great thing to do, though, and we should encourage it because it's a waste product and we can get electricity from it, and so it saves a lot of money and it's not creating additional emissions. So I guess whether you consider that renewable or not, I don't know. But if it's going to, for example, if it would, I think you just said 500 megawatts in Minnesota Power's territory. Did I hear you wrong?
No.
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Anderson, no, I said it would be much less than 500 megawatts because, in our territory, maybe 3 compressor stations, 5 megawatts each is 15. We have 4 or 5 industrial customers. I don't know what the size would be there, but say they were similar. 5 times 5 be 25, 65. So it sounds like in our service territory we're not talking even 100 megawatts. But, again, having not gotten out there and really kicked the bushes, but it takes a certain scale. You're not going to do this on just any industrial process. There needs to be enough scale. Like I said, there's 2 to 12 megawatts was the wheelhouse for this technology. As you get smaller, the costs are not going to look as good and they're not going to be competitive.
Okay. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be another one of those freshman questions clarifying. I appreciate Senator Rosen's comment about being on this committee for 5 years and so many of you that these terms are clear in your minds. You know where you walked before. As a layperson, right, just coming into this for the first time, when I think about renewables, I think about the source of the energy. So if we use biomass, that's renewed because it grows year after year, and wind comes back year after year. But it sounds like, now I may be misunderstanding that, what we're doing is we're taking a carbon source, and we're using it more efficiently. But once it's used, it's used. Am I misunderstanding what that the renewable concept is the source of the energy, not how well we use it? Am I misunderstanding something here? Those of you who have talked and put things into the equation of what is and what is not a renewable. And I don't know who should answer that.
That's the same thing.
It's energy recovery.
I would direct your attention to all of the bills. 216B.1691 under the definitions, subdivision 1, section 1, which includes an energy recovery facility used to capture the heat value of mixed municipal solid waste or refuse-derived fuel from mixed municipal solid waste as primary fuel, or which would be a similar process, I would assume.
But the solid waste, excuse me, Madam Chair, the solid waste is something that
has been used and is now being used for, same as this.
But
it's been used for energy and now it's being used for energy again.
It regenerates itself. Give me examples of solid waste. Is that like the corn husks or the?
Garbage.
Garbage, right. But that's something that we continue to create and it will be in a continuous flow, whereas natural gas or coal or any of those, once we use it, it's used.
Mr. Anderson, if wind energy were used, could you reuse that same energy also?
That's not the point, but...
Okay.
The wind energy, and we don't create the wind energy. The wind energy is there because of the way the geophysical part of our world works. It's constantly there. The gas and the coal and this stuff is in the ground or somewhere, and we extract it. Once we extract it and use it, it's gone. So those sources of energy, in my opinion, are not renewable, even if we can use them more efficiently. Those sources that, by nature of the way the world works, whether it's growing grasses or the manure from our animals or the wind, that those are the renewable ones that we have no, we, part of the problem is we have no control of them always, but they are there and they will be there. And this is just a freshman question again. It's
right.
a technicality, but it does carry all these other tales to it.
Senator Daw.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. Going back to what you said, the goal here was to reduce our carbon emissions and to generate electricity with clean, safe energy. And whether we're going to capture that power from heat or from light or from wind or from water or from garbage or from steam, I mean, it's either a natural source or it's a man-made source. And it's about capturing this and reusing it one way or another. And I'm looking at having us to have that flexibility for the utilities out there to meet, you know, their needs. And it's also about generating ideas outside of this room that are going to occur later on and not tying ourselves in to say, well, only these things will qualify. It's really about how we're going to capture that energy in one form and putting it into another without raising our carbon emissions. And I don't see myself a difference whether it's man-made source or it's a natural source. So I'd like to see us use those options that they're, you know, Minnesota Power is bringing out, even if it's just a little bit. You know, all those little stamps add up to something. You know, and Minnesota is going to do its part, and it's going to have an effect in the world. But I would encourage us to really open our thinking to those options.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion here,
Madam Chair?
Senator Sharon,
may I ask a question?
Certainly.
This will be a freshman question, too.
You know what?
It's okay to ask any question you want
because we're all learning here.
Yay, freshman question.
Your chair is learning.
That's great. You talked about after you use this a second time, that the emission is at a lower temperature. I'm trying to remember something that I learned at this great university earlier at another meeting about that, about the implication of a lower temperature on emissions and its impact on greenhouse gases. Can you explain that to me? Is there a relationship between those two things?
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Sharon, first of all, I'd like to say I'm a rookie, too, so I've never done this before. And relative to greenhouse gas, I mean, as these systems are designed, there's a lot of things that come into play on them because they have to make sure they don't take out so much heat that the gas is no longer buoyant. It's got to get up because, you know, it goes up and disperses, and that's what it does now at the 900 degrees. There's a lot of things that come into play. But the constituents, what's in there, whatever it might be, it stays the same. So I would say that the impact up there would be less. I mean, theoretically, it's at a lower temperature, so, you know, there's less actual BTUs or heat content going into the atmosphere, but that's really not a material thing.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think the reason the question is being raised is I've been talking with the staff a lot lately, too, that there are a lot of other renewable energy sources such as tidal energy and wave energy and hydrogen energy and a lot of other renewable sources that aren't a part of our definition. Do we want to limit ourselves or do we want to include what we can to make the option of using renewable sources as ready and available as possible and encourage people to use those renewable sources? This is one other that has just come to mind.
Yeah.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And I do believe that it's important we have this discussion about the definition of renewable and we come to some consensus on what are we talking about here. And I think it's easy to just get locked into the goal of the bills here about what it's doing to utilities and transmission, but there's a whole big world out there. And in my world, which is the home of wind and methane coming from hog setups and some other wonderful things coming down the line, that we just can't, you know, stay focused on the definition that's in three of the four bills. I think we do have to take a broader look at that and say, I mean, there's some great initiatives coming down in my little district about using the methane from the hog setups and having one central point to generate electricity to the surrounding homes and businesses. And will that ever happen? But I would hate to do anything in this committee to stop the growth and the imagination and the push that we have already started. And we've made such great progress with wind and renewables already that we should not just say, okay, this is where we're going to earmark it.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this is a great conversation, too. I'm enjoying it immensely because I think we're learning a lot and expanding our thinking. And you know, let me be clear, I'm not fighting this. I think it may be a great idea. I just think, I've missed one meeting, by the way, not a bunch of meetings. And so this is the so sick, and I don't think
Did
you wanted me to
bunch?
Be here. You said several. I don't think you wanted me to be here, or else you all would miss the next meeting. Questions need to be, it needs to be probed a little bit and thought about. I think Senator Carlson raised a good point. Are we locking ourselves into, some industrial processes that may be less than efficient, because now all of a sudden we're depending on those as a source of energy, and it's going to be part of the portfolio that a utility is trying to achieve. And, what is the sustainability of that particular industry in that particular area? And, and sometimes it feels like a little double standard. We had to know everything there is to know, soup to nuts, about, one technology, but someone comes in and says, oh, here's a great idea. And it's considered impolite to probe a few questions. So, I think it's okay to take a look, ask a few questions, and really get down to the nuts and bolts of what is our goal with developing renewable and alternatives, and they're not necessarily the same thing, and what are we not trying to achieve by going down this road.
Senator Carlson.
Hey, Madam Chair, I guess I wanted to add on to what Senator Rummel said, that this is really conservation of energy, because this heat and exhaust gas is made by burning or using it in a prime mover in a turbine. So it's natural gas that's making this heat. So like Senator Rummel said, that this is really not a renewable resource that's being used to make the original heat. And probably one of the ways you can compare it is a home furnace. We had home furnaces that required using a chimney. That chimney used heat to drive the gases up and out of the chimney. Once you had more expensive, newer furnaces, you couldn't use chimneys anymore because the exhaust heat wasn't hot enough to drive the exhaust out. It would actually condense in the chimney and water would run out of it. So you had to have a different system to exhaust that gas. Now, almost every furnace that's made and sold today is a condensing type of furnace, where the exhaust gases are so cool you can put your hand in them. And that's conservation. That's not renewables. It's just making better use of the original gas that's going into your furnace. And that's kind of what I was driving at before here, too, is that what we have off the page is a gas turbine that's exhausting 850 to 950 degree gases. Those gases are full of carbon dioxide, probably some carbon monoxide, probably a lot of NOx and all sorts of things. And we would best try to figure out what we can do with that end of the process. If you could put up some wind turbines and run those pumps with wind energy, you wouldn't have any pollution whatsoever, and that would be using a renewable resource to drive these pumps. Now, I'm not familiar with the size of the prime movers that are used here, but that is a way to use a renewable resource to completely eliminate the need for this kind of conservation. So what we're doing is we're actually in conservation. Now, again, this may be a conventional way of powering a pumping station, but it's just using the hot gases from it is not creating a renewable use of it. It's just using something that's a waste.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Carlson's kind of stolen my thunder. I agree with you, and I agree with our speaker here, that we need to capture all the energy we possibly can and we need to be as inventive and as innovative as we can. But I think we need to make sure we put the right ones in the right pots. And I don't know if we have other initiatives coming through in conservation that would support and help this particular idea along. But I think we should have them in the right pot. And I do not believe this qualifies. Renewable energy to me is less dependent on carbon, things that eventually will run out, and whatever they are. So I would like to keep that as broad as possible, but we have to exclude certain things that will run out eventually, resources that eventually will run out, and then the kinds of initiatives that we just heard about, put those under initiatives related to conservation.
Any further comments, Mr. Anderson?
The only one I would come back to, I think Senator Sohn, Madam Chair, you brought up municipal solid waste. That's an interesting one because that is in the standard right now. And as I think of municipal solid waste, my layman's understanding of it, other than I produce a lot of it, it's made up of different materials. There's materials in there that will break down and degrade and maybe form methane that can be burned, can generate power. There's also materials in there such as plastics that come from petroleum products, petroleum resources that are burned and used to make energy. So in some ways, there's a bit of a parallel there with what we have put forward.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to ask you to stay there. I know that Bill Grant wants to come and speak to us and probably give a different perspective on this. And so I'm going to ask you to just stay there for a minute, too. Welcome,
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League and also representing Clean Energy Minnesota. And I really do appreciate your indulgence, Madam Chair, in allowing me to testify a second time on this important bill. First thing I want to say is that the Isaac Walton League certainly, and I know many of the other Clean Energy Minnesota members, have always been supportive of capturing waste heat as a way to improve efficiency in all sorts of industrial applications. Our work on this dates back to legislation in the mid-90s that was being pursued by what was then known as Koch Refinery to conduct some industrial cogeneration at their facility, and we were supportive then of their engaging in that sort of activity and would be now. We don't feel, however, that because the prime mover here is a fossil fuel, that it's appropriate to include this form of project in a renewable energy standard. We believe, as Senator Dibble and others have pointed out, that this would be a more appropriate discussion for legislation that's to come yet in your committee, Madam Chair, regarding energy efficiency. This is, in effect, a supply-side efficiency effort, and we would be supportive of thinking about ways to encourage it as we try to meet the goal that we hope that the state will adopt to dramatically increase the amount of efficiency that we're getting both on the demand side of the meter and on the supply side. We have no idea of the scale of the impact of an amendment of this sort. Of course, we're not just talking about what's on Minnesota Power's system. There are pipelines crisscrossing the state that have compressor motors that are driven in the same way and produce waste heat in the same manner. As someone suggested earlier, if we are going to consider this as a practical amendment to this bill, then we really do need to have a better sense of the scale of it. And it's hard for me to think that once we do consider this type of an amendment, that there won't be similar amendments for other also worthy energy kinds of projects that certainly are not renewable, but that are things that the state ought to be supporting. We do not support the inclusion of a non-renewable technology in a bill setting a renewable energy standard. The fact that other states have included non-renewable sources in state legislation should not deter Minnesota from taking a leadership position on the development of our own renewable energy sources. The example that's been given is that Basin Electric in North Dakota is already utilizing this technology, and it is an allowable or it is included in the North Dakota definition of renewable energy. Of course, North Dakota does not have a renewable energy objective or standard, so that frees Basin Electric to not only take advantage of that technology on their system, but to sell credits that would be generated by those projects into the Minnesota market if we, in fact, allow this in our definition. So this has a broader effect, Madam Chair and members, than just simply what might happen in Minnesota. We're very concerned about the precedent for allowing language that may encourage others to bring forward ideas that have the effect of reducing the amount of renewables that we generate in Minnesota. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take any further questions that the committee has.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Any questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps we should call this bill the Alternative Energy Bill instead of the Renewable Energy. But actually, this question is for Mr. Fuller. Do we have a definition on conservation in statute? And I don't believe we just looked it up, and I don't believe we do, but we really don't have an idea. What is conservation? What is renewable?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen, everything else into alternative.
In the conservation investment program, if it's not exactly that term, it might be called a conservation investment. But there's a list of things that qualify under that program, whether, you know, it would apply to other statutes. But, yeah, the concept of what is conservation is in the statutes in a different context.
Madam Chair, it'd be nice to know at some point this: what is the definition of a conservation, or what it says in the statutes as far as.
You want that now?
Okay.
Yeah.
216B 241.
Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just wondering why we think we have to pick each one of these. Wouldn't it be more important to know that the fuel or whatever it is has substitution characteristics, so that if we decide that it's not renewable, it would be substitutable and look more at emissions and cost, weighing that into the factor too. Is that? This is kind of my question. I mean, is it our intent to pick every single item that is going to be considered renewable, or is that?
Is that your question of me?
Possibly, Madam Chair, yes. I mean, it might be a freshman question. I think it's really good. I think it's really good that you let freshmen talk in the Senate.
I don't have the answer for you, Senator Vandiver. I do know that we do have a definition that includes a number of different sources, but I'm also aware that there are a number of different sources that are used in other states, too, that are not a part of our definition. And so I raised the question to see if there is some value in including some other options for the state. Mr. Fuller has an answer for Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, Member Senator Rosen, Section 216B.241, Subdivision 1, Clause E, energy conservation, and this is in the context of the Conservation Investment Program, means demand-side management of energy supplies resulting in a net reduction in energy use. That's in that statute.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, as we've been sitting here, I've had a chance to look over some of the bills, and something struck me in the language on Ellen Anderson's bill and on your bill on page 1 from 1.9 to 1.14. where it says hydrogen, right after the megawatts, after the 100 megawatts, it says provided that after January 1st, 2010, the hydrogen must be generated from the sources or resources listed in this clause or biomass, which includes an energy recovery, and it goes on. So as I read that, it says that biomass or energy, municipal solid waste, or any of those fuels can only be used for producing hydrogen. Am I reading that wrong?
Mr. Fuller, do you want to respond?
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, yes, there's a. You are reading it wrong. The hydrogen must be generated from the resources listed in this clause, semicolon, or biomass. So that's the modification of hydrogen stops at the semicolon.
Okay. Are there any further questions of Mr. Grant or Mr. Anderson? Okay, then. I thank you both for your testimony and for helping us to have a lively discussion. I'm not sure where it's gotten us at this point, but we will take it into consideration. Is there any further discussion right now by committee members? Any questions? Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Bear with me, but I do have a couple questions about transmission. Transmission lines as far as, and they're very simple. I'm a very simple, basic person here. But how does this work with transmission lines and eminent domain? And what has the problems in the past been as far as getting these people to accept a transmission line going through their property? Are we overreaching ourselves? I mean. I can just share with you that there's some emails and some correspondence coming from my district where people are very concerned about more wind generation showing up in their neighborhoods. And you're going to get your usual complaint. Is it a wind tower or a hog setup? I mean, that's basically the options out there, but. I just wonder if what it's been like in the past where transmission has been stymied because of issues dealing with eminent domain or property rights, and have we addressed that completely to date?
Mr. Fuller has agreed to take a stab at it.
Madam Chair, the recent history has shown, I mean, we haven't built a lot of transmission lines recently, but the ones from southwestern Minnesota since there was a better feeling that this was going to benefit the area, that there was that there would be some economic benefit to those in the region where the lines are running through. That is thought to be one of the reasons why there wasn't violent protests. I mean, the utilities tried to. The Electric Energy Task Force looked into this somewhat a couple of years ago, because basically the farm community was saying they wanted to get a piece of the action of the electricity going over a line, not just payment for the easement. And so in that forum, we learned from the utilities that they try to negotiate. They very rarely go to condemnation. They said, and I hope they do, that they offer the same price to everybody. It's not how good a negotiator you are. And that if somebody extracts a higher price, they'll go back and make that same offer to somebody else. So have we addressed the issue of whether or not people will be upset about transmission line? I don't think it's an issue that's capable of being fully addressed by legislation. The tools are there for people to, if they're dissatisfied with the offer, to go to court and get some commissioners to put a value on what they're giving up, and it can be litigated. But beyond that, unless you want to either require a certain amount of money, which will drive up the cost for everybody, or give some state money. I mean, it's basically a money issue. And it's also a not in my backyard issue as well. I mean, nobody wants it across their land. And, you know, that who knows what people will respond to when things, it'll be variable. But I think what the recent experience has shown that if people know that the utility, you know, is not somebody who's trying to take it away for no good reason, that there's electricity that's needed, it's going to benefit Minnesotans, and you educate people, I don't think they're happy, but they may not take the bolts out of the transmission tower and do things like that.
Okay. Any other questions at this time? Okay. What I'd like to do is to have Mr. Fuller walk us through then where we are in terms of the delete all amendment. And as it's being passed out to all of you, I would like you to know that tomorrow at 3 p.m. in room 123 of the Capitol, we are having another stakeholders meeting. So if the stakeholders wish to attend, would they please notify my committee administrator, Jenny Meyer, that you will be attending? I'd also like to remind members that instead of our regular committee meeting next Tuesday, we'll be joining seven other House and Senate committees on the floor of the House chamber for a presentation on global warming. There'll be the Senate committees on energy, utilities, technology, and communications, environment, energy, and natural resources budget division, environment, natural resources policy division, transportation budget and policy division, and also the House committees, including Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division, Environment and Natural Resources Policy Division, Energy Finance and Policy Division, and Transportation Finance Division. This is going to be a large committee meeting. It should be exciting. The presentation will be primarily informational with time for members' questions at the end. We plan to begin at 4 p.m. and end by 6 p.m. And did I mention that the meeting will be held in the House chamber? Committee members and staff are encouraged to attend. If you do plan on attending, again, please let Jenny Meyer, my CA, know so that she can make sure that there is space for you on the floor. And if you have any questions, you can also contact my office. And another thing is perhaps to update you on what our schedule is for continuing on in the session. There are many issues for our committee to deal with after we vote on the RES bill. And so we are in the process of constructing the timeline for dealing with the various issues, and they will be the seabed legislation and economic development, energy efficiency, transmission, reducing carbon emissions, and telecommunication. Energy efficiency and conservation, should say. So if you're planning to author legislation to any of these areas, please let us know so that we can plan the timelines accordingly and schedule our committee meetings and try to use our time as effectively as possible. But that will be the schedule. It will be the seabed and economic development issues next, and then energy and efficiency and conservation. Mr. Fuller is going to walk us through the delete all amendment as it stands today, then to remind you that there are still a few issues to work out.
Thank you, members. Just to remind you what this is, Chair Solon is trying to prepare an amendment that Senator Anderson finds agreeable. There is no agreement yet with respect to anything, but there's discussions, and these reflect the discussions. What I did was I took Senate File 4 as the base. So you'll find it's that bill. Some of that language is still in there. It may still be under discussion, but let's go through it. It's this document that says draft on it. On page 1, line 8, the increase of the hydropower capacity that will qualify from 60 to 100. And on page 1, line 12, landfill gas is included. The thought was that it was. I think people were in agreement it was. It just wasn't clearly expressed. And just a point, you know, we don't really call this renewables. We call it eligible energy technology, so you'll see that term. And that's the term of art that's used to describe these qualifying technologies. I hope that's not renewable. All right. The next change is in subdivision 2, where the current energy objective, which was to go in 1% increments from 1 to 10 by 2015, is curtailed at 10 in 2010. I'm sorry, 5 at 2010. And then that language that's stricken at the bottom of the page, all the way up to the next page, is that biomass set-aside, where in the present law it says that a certain percent of the technology that can qualify has to be a biomass. It's been interpreted by the Public Utilities Commission to mean a percent of that percent that has to be eligible energy technology, so it's quite small. And since the goal was flexibility in responding, we've had that discussion, this allows for it. It's still eligible. It's just not mandatory to have a certain percentage. And then on page 2, line 7, this is language lifted from Senate File 4, because that was the base document. So this is the switch to a standard. And it's the same utilities, the same definitions. It's for everything else, it's just a standard. 2013, 11%. 2015, 15%. 2020, 25%. Now on 2.16 to 2.18, I guess you could describe that as a renewable or an eligible energy technology that's going to be eliminated from consideration. That would be facilities placed in service before 1975, except for hydropower and biomass in Minnesota. The net practical effect is that the largest effect that's known is that some XL hydropower in Wisconsin of about 200 megawatts plus that's allocated to Minnesota would no longer be able to be counted towards satisfying that company's standard. On 2.22, all the way, and just stay there, but all the way to 3.1 are what has become known as the off-ramps. Starting at 2.22, the commission may modify or delay a standard obligation if the commission determines it is in the public interest to do so. So it may. They have discretion. Commission may modify or delay a standard obligation to implement standards in the most so as to implement standards in the most cost-effective way for customers to ensure reliability of the electric system and to accommodate technical advances or concerns or to meet other statutory obligations. Those three criteria are the ones that have been in all the bills and have been discussed. To meet other statutory obligations, I want to talk about that tomorrow at the stakeholder group because I'm not totally clear what was meant by that when they agreed. I assume it means there's other things that are going on and they can direct where renewables are implicated and this does not take away from their authority to address it. But I think that's something that we'll have to clarify tomorrow. And then the next sentence is a limitation on the power to modify. They may not modify or delay a standard obligation solely because it causes some rate impact, requires some measures to address reliability, or raises some technical issues for several reasons, one being that any new generation will probably have some of those impacts. So the fact that they do would not necessarily trigger this action. It'd have to be something that raised to the level that when considering it, it was in the public interest to delay or modify. And so you go to the sentence on 2.28, where the balance is trying to be struck here between doing these meeting these standards, complying, and having the ability to be flexible. So this sentence says the commission may not modify. No, I'm sorry. It says the commission must give due consideration and significant deference to achieving the standards set by this section and to a preference for electric generation through use of eligible energy technologies. So a balancing concept. When the utility comes before it says it costs us X amount more, they make a record, and then the commission would say, yes, but, you know, we want renewables, and we're going to balance this in the public interest, considering these factors of reliability, rate impact, and feasibility, and we'll come to a decision on those bases, sort of a reasonable conclusion. Then this would be called, I guess, the muni portion, the 2.31. This was in the Senator Thomasoni bill. The commission shall, so no discretion here, they shall modify or delay a standard obligation if the commission finds that due to circumstances beyond an electric utility's control, so it's beyond their control, it's not something that they participated in creating, it is not feasible to meet the standard due to, one, there's three of them, delays in acquiring sites or routes or due to rejection of necessary siting or other permitting approvals. This is word for word, I think, other bill. So if it's beyond their, you know, it's beyond their control, they've done everything they can do, and there's an interruption, under this language, the commission has to delay or modify it. So, okay, so you're aware of that. It's not a discretionary authority. It's a requirement. Two is another reason. Delays, cancellations, or non-delivery of necessary equipment for construction or commercial operation of an eligible energy facility. Okay, so they just can't get the stuff. That's pretty self-explanatory. And three is transmission constraints preventing delivery of service. So that was the one we heard a lot about. And later on, we'll see the balance for that. There's some obligations later on to try to get this transmission up on the part of utilities. This next section is a new one, the new language. So tomorrow we'll talk about it. Some people have seen it. Most people have not. 3.2 to 3.10 tries to address the issue of if there is this flexibility granted, what's the most efficient process for a utility to be able to try to get it invoked for the PUC to implement? Because we don't want a situation, I think, where it costs $4 million to get a decision that saves you $1 million, something like that. You know. Okay, so what it says is that an electric utility may request the commissioner to exercise this authority under subdivision 2A, which is the one we just talked about, their authority to modify or delay, as part of the integrated resource planning process under section 216B.2422, which both munis and co-ops and investor-owned utilities go through. The order of the commission with respect to an investor-owned utility in that process is final and binding. It's advisory with respect to a muni or co-op, but there's language in here that says, no, with respect to this issue, it's not advisory. It also makes it explicit on line 3.8 that this subdivision, in addition to, does not limit the commission's authority to modify or delay a standard obligation in other proceedings. And the goal of that is, okay, we got this one process, and maybe that doesn't work for you because of time factors. You can ask for a delay or modification in another process. So that's the thinking here. I think tomorrow we'll look at and see if it carries out the intent. It's the best language to provide efficient procedure, efficient process for invoking this authority to modify or delay. Okay. Subdivision 2C, I think there's nothing substantial there. So subdivision 3, just conforming amendments to use new terminology. Renewable energy credits, I want to thank everybody. I mean, the regulators and utilities and environmentalists met. They may not have seen this yet, but this tries to reflect their agreement. And if it doesn't, we'll fix it. There's two reasons why we want to meet tomorrow, just so members know. One is that people who have reached agreements and then they come up with language, we'd like to find out what those agreements were to make sure the language reflects that. Because sometimes people think that they've accomplished something, and in fact, they haven't. So, and then just to see if there's new issues. So there's two reasons. And in the energy credit part of it, it's now become mandatory for the PUC to get up and running by January 1st, 2008. And the utilities can use these credits to satisfy their obligation. They can be counted. No renewable technology is given preference over any other. And it can be banked. So if you buy excess credits in 1 year, they can be applied towards your future obligation, whatever that is. And also the definition of what's a renewable is what's our state's law. So if another state has a law that says this, well, we just heard they have different definitions, that won't count. It has to satisfy our definition. And then the commission is given authority to order utilities to participate. I should say that on 5.12 to that whole subdivision, that's XL's particular obligation. We heard them testify that it causes them problems. They have different buckets, different description, how they satisfy it. There are talks going on. We'll see what happens. On page 6.3 is the compliance section. The Public Utilities Commission must regularly investigate whether an electric utility is in compliance with its good faith objective under Subdivision 2 and standard obligation under Subdivision 2A. Then if the commission finds noncompliance, it may order the electric utility to construct facilities, purchase energy generated by eligible energy technology. Just to alert the audience, there's some new language in here, so a couple things added.
purchase credits, or engage in other activities to achieve compliance. The thought is we want to give the commission a big toolbox to issue orders to achieve compliance and not limit it just to purchasing credits or constructing facilities, but also to purchasing the actual renewable generated electricity. Then, after the order, if the electric utility fails to comply with an order, the commission may impose a financial penalty that's limited to the lesser of the estimated cost, or to the estimated cost of compliance, which is the cost of construction or purchase of credits. Then it's made explicit that this subdivision is in addition to any other enforcement authority they may have. So if, in fact, there are some other tools available to them, we don't want to limit those other tools. That's the intent. 6.16 is new language. That's the balance for the transmission off-ramp. I'm not going to read it. I think we'll probably, you know, this was brought in recently and inserted in there, but the thought is to have them engage in activities, the electric utilities, to plan for the transmission that's required to comply with renewables. And so that's the intent of that section. We'll go over it tomorrow to make sure that this is the best language to accomplish that intent as the balance to the transmission off-ramp. Because the thought is it's the utilities that are doing the transmission construction, and so if they could in essence generate their own off-ramp by not doing the transmission work. The repealer is something absolutely new. That repealer is of the green pricing program. You see it's repealed out to January 1, 2010. That's new. There was some discussion in the stakeholder groups. We'll find out if it's controversial. It wasn't then. The reason being that twofold. One is that it's an education program and people are learning about it. Two, I mean, it's that purpose will probably be satisfied. Two is you can't count the energy sold under this program against your renewable obligation. That's a PUC interpretation of the two laws. And so at some point in time, if you're selling a lot under this program, it's going to stretch you. So get a big pot and count everything, basically, is the thought. That's it. Any questions?
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
I have a question on 2.11. That is, what is the definition of retail? Because we've been hearing from a lot, like Minnesota Power saying they have all these industrial commercial generators. Are they considered a wholesale customer then?
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, not generally. I mean, there may be some peculiar circumstance that somebody is, but they would be retail customers.
If I do an estimate on something or sell something list price, you know, that's different than if I sell something wholesale or to a, you know, there's different, I would think that there might have to be a better definition of what retail means.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't think it's been a problem, but if you want more information, I mean, the PUC is here and they can tell us if they're grappling with this issue at the moment or people are having problems. It's a fair question.
Is there somebody that could come to the table and explain? Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Just please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission.
Welcome, Commissioner Haar. Did you get the question?
No, I did not. I'm sorry.
The question is...
the bill.
Okay. Would you like to repeat yourself?
On 2.11, they talk about, or it says, standard percentages of the electric utilities, total retail electric sales to retail customers. In my world, a retail customer is somebody like a homeowner. It's not an industrial user who is buying huge volumes of electricity. So what is the definition of retail in that context?
Let me answer this.
Just a minute, Mr. Haar. Mr. Fuller is going to respond.
Just as a partial answer, Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, on page 1.18, I don't think this goes to the heart of your question, but just as a point of information, there is a definition of total retail electric sales. Not sure that addresses your particular concern, but it's there.
Okay. Mr. Haar, is there anything that you could add?
Well, I could respond in a
utilities tariff, there are different classes of customers. There are residential class, there's a residential class, a commercial class, industrial class, and it varies by utilities. And members of those class are the end users. They're the people that use, they're the entities that use the power. Those are the retail customers, I think, by our understanding or the way we, the way the commission would interpret that. I don't know that there's any specific definition beyond what Mr. Fuller mentioned to you.
So, Senator Alcine, does that answer your question?
Yeah, because if they're talking about those three classes and they're all considered the same, it's just that it strikes me, you know, the wholesale, retail, and I thought maybe they were on a different rating system. I assume they are on a different rating system. So I didn't know if they would be considered retail.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? I don't know if you want to take time to digest the bill or if you want to talk about aspects of it at this time. And understanding that still a lot of this is under negotiation. Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, I have a question on 2.35, the delays, cancellation, non-delivery of necessary equipment for construction or commercial operation. There again, it seems to me that there might be some possible manipulation that, for instance, a late order or something like that. How will you determine that that's something that is out of control of the entity?
Okay. For a legal definition, I'm going to ask Mr. Fuller or interpretation.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, I thought I could answer you. I mean, I will, but how do you determine that it's out of the control would be a factual question. And if you're going to have a standard that's based on fact, you'll have factual questions. So that's inherent. So what the PUC has done in the context of the good faith effort, they have adopted basically a rational test. What would a reasonable person do in these circumstances, understanding what their obligations were? So I would assume that they would do the same thing here. They would say, did this utility do what a reasonable utility would do if it was trying to comply with its obligation under this section? And if, in fact, normal commercial practice was, or there was notice that you needed so much time to do something and they didn't do it, then it wouldn't have been beyond their control.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Fuller, what I'm thinking of is, for instance, if I have a choice of buying a turbine at an upcharge of 100% versus buying it at without an upcharge, what would a reasonable, how would you determine what's reasonable there? I would not want to buy it at an upcharge of 100% if there's not enough capacity to build turbines, so I would wait until the last minute to perhaps order it, which may cause a non-delivery.
Mr. Fuller?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, I think then you've raised an issue that we'll have to discuss tomorrow. You're saying you're not comfortable that this is tight enough to prevent manipulation.
Correct.
So I'll make a note of that now, and then we'll get back to you, and you know, you'll determine whether you're satisfied or not.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Senator Sharon.
Madam Chair, in the discussions under the same 2.35, I noticed that there were concerns during testimony that if there was this standard at 25 by 20, that the cost of the product to create the energy would inflate to a degree that would affect rates substantively. And I don't read anything in here that acknowledges that as an issue.
No, it does.
And Mr. Fuller suggests it might.
Madam Chair, Senator Sheeran, if you look up at 2.24, now this is, remember I said there's two sets of authorities. One is the mandatory set, the 1-3, and then there's the discretionary set. And on 2.24, the commission may modify to their standards so it's allow the standard to be implemented in the most cost-effective way. So what would happen, and that's the concept. We'll bring it before the group tomorrow and see if that expresses it well, that if, in fact, there's a way to do it that's less costly, I mean, it doesn't detract from the public interest of getting it up, that the commission has authority to say, okay, we'll change it to accommodate it. They may do that. But they would make that decision in the public interest, balancing our interest, the legislation's interest in getting renewables with the interest of not causing undue cost impacts on, ultimately, the customers. So that's how that's dealt with here.
You look like you still are puzzled by that, Senator Sharon.
Well, I'm thinking about coming before the commission and asking for relief. How will I know how that decision will be made? How that will be determined? Is there any kind of frame of reference around that? For example, if the rates would increase by a certain percentage, do we know whether or not we have an agreement about what that means to be? When does it not become in the public's best interest to pursue this objective in terms of cost?
Fuller.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that's the question. I mean, the question is, what's the balance between being mandatory and specifying something and giving the flexibility of the decision maker to look at the whole record and come to a conclusion based on the Galaxy effect? So if you had a statute that said if there's a 3% increase, you don't have to do it, or in rates, that may not be in the public interest. It may be that some alternative would be 4% or 5%. So that's your question goes to the heart of how you allow the decision maker to make the decision. Do you say if you have to put up 6 more transformers or the reliability or put up a new substation? So yes, you've hit the heart of the matter. And this is going in the direction of saying, we're going to give some guidance to the commission, and hopefully enough that any reasonable person would agree with what happened, given our goal of installing renewable energy. And if I think once you start down the path towards giving parameters for all the decisions, you'd end up saying you'd have some escape hatch, unless the public interest requires otherwise. I mean, so you'd come back right at the beginning because you'd realize you've trapped yourself, maybe. So, I mean, that's the dilemma.
Madam Chair?
I think that what Mr. Fuller is saying is that we need to give specific enough guidelines, but also rely on the expertise of the Public Utilities Commission, who has been dealing with these on an ongoing basis and has to address many of these when they set rates or help to set rates also to define this or to... I think Mr. Fuller's telling me I'm wrong.
Oh, no, you're right. No. Yes, I'm up. But Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I mean, the commission has rulemaking authority. And if you turn to... And so they may go down that path at some point in time. They may develop a body of expertise that they can put into a rule that gives more guidance. They may not. And then secondly, if you turn to page 3.2, one of the things that hasn't happened, mused about it, is there a way, I mean, is it advisable to give the PUC authority to issue letter opinions or to give advice in a certain way or some economical way where the public still has input? So that also goes to your question. Can we enlarge the process in a way that people are comfortable with, people who want the renewables built, and those who have to build them, that there is a way to get an opinion, to get a decision that isn't replete with a lot of process? I mean, can you send a letter and say, if we came in and said we can do it 6 months after the deadline, are you okay with that? But so how do you get to? We'll talk about it tomorrow. I mean, it's important because these things require a lot of money, and I think you're onto something that requires some thought.
Senator Sharon,
Madam Chair, thank you. I do think that this is a difficult thing to define ahead of time. And I know that we're talking about, and I'm very committed to, a renewable energy standard. At the same time, and I don't want a complicated process at the PUC that delays everything and is costly to everybody. At the same time, I think when I think about from the utilities perspective, if to the degree that we can be as clear as we can about how that decision will be made would be helpful. Or is there an appeal process? Perhaps there is now that I don't understand, where an outcome can be mediated. Or is the PUC's decision a final decision? How does that operate?
Madam Chair, Senator Sheeran, you can appeal from a PUC decision to the Court of Appeals, and it happens. But we don't want that to happen.
We don't want to have a process in place here that is longer than the permitting process. I'm just concerned that it's unclear to me when I read this. How are we tipping the balance here in terms of the cost to the production of the energy, so that when we know that the cost is not in the best interest of the public? Because we want to keep energy affordable also.
So that's a tough question, and I'm not sure anybody has the answer to that. And it may be something that has to get worked out along the process as we see the effects on the ratepayers, I guess. Other questions or comments? We have more questions than we have answers, don't we? maybe this would be a good time to close then. I would ask members, please, to leave the bills in your folder tonight. We've been recopying them often, so you probably have several copies in your office. If you would leave them in your folders in case you need them for our next meeting. And remember, on Tuesday is the Global Warming Conference, so our next meeting here will be a week from tonight. I would really like us to be able to vote on this bill at that time. So I'm hoping that you give it consideration, and we will try to keep you updated. I'll try to meet with the various caucuses to also inform you about the progress that's made by the stakeholders groups. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say that I don't think you meant that people should put the delete all amendment, that people probably are going to want to take that and read that. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you for the clarification, Senator Anderson. Please do take the draft with you. Meeting is adjourned.